Blog Talk Radio.
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission:
to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Hey, good evening, guys. Welcome to Comic Corner. I hope you liked the beginning. What do you guys think? Did you like that?
Yeah, that's nice.
From the final episode of Enterprise, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I like that.
Because, you know, if we're doing a Discovery, I can play a Discovery. But this, you know, Comic Corner kind of, we never know what we're going to do. So I kind of wanted something that would encompass Star Trek.
And that song is probably the one redeeming quality about that episode. So good job, Jim.
Yeah, so I thought we would use it. So that's why we have that.
But I think in today's bag, it's such a mixed bag anyway.
Yeah, we got a little bit. The only thing is there's no Deep Space Nine in there. They kind of only use Enterprise, but they didn't have Deep Space Nine didn't have a prologue. Neither did Voyager, for that matter. So it's all right. It works. It works. Anyways, guys, we're going to be talking about some really great comic books this month. We're going to be talking about Too Long a Sacrifice, issue number 2 of 4. And we're also going to be talking about Hill's Mirror, which is the Mirror Con book. That's a one-shot, so it's one and done. And we'll be with you for the next hour. So our number here is 646-668-2433. And if you want to give us a call and share your insights, or just say hello, please give us a call. We'd love to hear from you. 646-668-2433. And which one do you guys want to start out with?
Ooh. Well, in my pile sitting on my desk in front of me, I have Deep Space Nine on top. I don't know. What do you guys think?
Yeah,
let's start with Deep
Space Nine. So we can get a little more in depth with Khan, depending on what time we've got.
All right.
Yeah. So I want to start with Deep Space Nine and say, I same thing I said last week. The cover didn't thrill me. I'm sorry, but they're just not grabbing me with these covers for Deep Space Nine. I don't know I don't know why they're so.
For this cover in particular, Jim, I totally agree with you. And my question is, okay, who is the guy in the doorway? Like, there's a guy standing in the doorway in Odo's office, silhouetted. I don't know who that is. And I don't know how that, like, relates to the story. I don't know. What do you think, Charles?
I wonder if he's the character we meet at the end.
I guess it could be, yeah. He doesn't exactly stroll into his office quite like that. But once again, we know from our discussions with JK that often the cover is painted completely independently from knowledge of the story. So maybe it was like, okay, we want you to put Odo in his office and stuff, and we want this showy fig in the doorway, and that's all you get. I think it's so dark, Jim, and it doesn't you know, I was kind of excited about this series because it kind of might have had a kind of pulpy sort of feel to it, you know, like the old Dick Tracy detectives kind of thing. And the cover doesn't speak to that to me.
Well, the alternate cover that's in the back of the book looks interesting. It looks like you said, the old pulpy fiction-y type of look to it.
Yeah, they've had like that they've had that kind of art noir sort of lettering and stuff going with that. And also, I think you're right, Jim. The reason I like that one a little bit better, and it would have been cool to have that as the A cover, is it's more dynamic, right? The everybody's a little pitched, like, and the lettering had like changes sizes as it comes across the page. it just looks more exciting. The cover that they chose as the A cover does not make me want to read, but if I see Garrick lurking behind a corner, that would be the one that I would read.
Yeah, that, exactly. I really like this alternate cover, but I don't like the primary cover here. It's just blah.
What's also interesting, I don't know if you noticed or not, Jim, but there's two covers in the back that are by two different artists that have the same pose. So we have the cover that was done by Ricardo Drummond, which is on our main cover. And then there was one done by J.K. Woodward that has Odo in the same position, almost identical position, but then has a little bit of a graphic overlay and more of a background. And I would say that one's even a little bit more interesting.
That's the only cover I could see is those two. I don't see the third one.
Mm-hmm.
If they use the JK cover, and use the graphics from the Deep Space Nine, the red graphics from the first cover. If they put those red graphics over Odo's head where those two spotlights are, that would be the cover right there.
That would work. That would totally work.
That would work, totally work for me, because it looks like Odo's looking at his pad, and these are the witnesses that he's going to talk to that are on his pad.
Totally.
And then Deep Space Nine with the red bleeding letters type over his head. But this one here, this cover, is just, I'm very disappointed. Comic book covers are a thing, and this run has not impressed me with the comic book covers. This is the second issue. And the second cover that's like, unfortunately.
Well, it's interesting that Drummond gets credit for the cover, but he's not an artist in the book, in the comic.
You know, that's often true when we review these books. The artist that's listed in the book, or the artists that might be listed in the book, are just the artists that are between the pages. And then the cover artist is usually listed separately. On this one, inside the cover of the paper copy, at least, they have the three different, the regular cover, the B cover, and then the retailer's incentive cover with all the different artists listed right down below all the regular artists and writers and stuff.
You know, what's funny though, Eric, I just noticed that exactly what I just said is what they did with the JK cover for the retailer's incentive cover. They took the red Deep Nine lettering and put it over Odo's head like I thought they should have done.
Yep.
I didn't
even
notice that.
Jim.
I'm glad I should be working for a comic book.
But it is interesting that they use them. Go ahead, Charles.
I wonder if when I see cover A, I look at that cover and it's like, it reminds me of the pocketbook. It reminds me of like a cover of one of the pocketbooks.
Uh-huh.
One of the old classic paperbacks.
You know, I think you're right. And I think what that speaks to is that within these pages, you will find a story about Odo investigating something, which I think is really appropriate for a book where you're going to, that's the story cover to cover, right? Odo investigates X, probably figures it out, heroes win. In this one, I think it doesn't work quite as well because of the episodic nature of these comics. So here we are in episode 2, issue 2. And, you know, of course we know Odo's investigating. And I don't think the shadowy figure that is in the cover plays enough of a part in this issue to warrant being on the cover. I think Jim's right. I think it's more interesting to have the suspects sort of shown, you know, like who's he thinking about? We already know from the last issue that Quark's going to be the number one suspect. And it's nice that we start there. But, you know, there's several other ones. The Benzite confuses me a little bit. That one hasn't come into the story yet. But but the Bajoran and the Nausicaan have.
Cover B is a little bit more interesting, but still not as great as the JK cover.
Yeah, the cover B continues their run of covers where they usually have one that is simply a photo from the series. They usually have the art cover, and then they usually have a photo cover. And in this case, it's just a photograph of Renee as Odo on the cover of number B or letter B there.
But my favorite one is the one that JK did. I really like that one. That's my. That's the one I. If I saw that, I would have bought the book in a heartbeat. Well, I buy the book in a heartbeat, anyways. But I mean, I would have.
Let's be honest.
Yeah, but
it says Star Trek.
I'm also gonna remember, these
it says Star Trek. I'm gonna buy
IDW
it.
IDW Star Trek. But, IDW
yeah,
Star Trek.
It
it's hard for us not to pick them up and read them.
Yeah,
but
I
you know, not
it
to
anyways.
Not to belabor this point at all, but the last observation I'll make about the cover is that the cover that I like the best, which is the one that's in the back of the issue and doesn't show up on the front page, doesn't have an artist attributed to it. All the other ones have the artist's name written underneath them, but the cover that has Garrick kind of lurking behind the wall there does not have an artist, as far as I can tell. So, interesting.
Uh-oh.
No, I agree with you guys.
Oh,
you know, I think you're right.
We lost him.
No. My wife came in and was. Yeah, I just had to mute it because the wife came in.
Got it. Okay.
But anyways, I agree. I agree completely. So let's dive right in and start talking about this one. So
sounds good.
Right off the bat, the one thing I thought was a little strange is why was Worf working with Odo on the investigation? We've never seen that before. Did you guys think that was a little bit weird?
Well, I think that Odo references that in this issue, and he says that he's kind of allowed Worf to tag along because he felt like he needed kind of outside input. So Odo, I think in this issue, is already starting to feel kind of stumped by the serial nature of these killings that we're having here. And so he was hoping that Worf would, you know, be able to offer something. And as it turns out in this issue, Worf does eventually offer something that Odo wasn't thinking of. And it turns out to be fruitful.
Right.
So a little weird, I guess. But what was Worf's title on DS9? He was commander, but what was he like in charge of?
He was wasn't he the tactical officer?
Is that what it was? Tactical?
I mean, that's what he was on
the Defiant.
On the Enterprise.
Well, he was
the
captain.
And, I mean,
yes.
On the Defiant.
Well, depending on where
I think
you are,
that's what
captain
he was.
At one point. Yeah.
Yeah. But at any rate, I just thought it was strange the Odo Worf thing because they were never really they were always at odds, it seemed, on the show.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, because
they never
Odo's
really saw
natural,
eye to eye.
No, they didn't, and it was because they both wanted to get down to the bottom of it, and Odo always had patience and Worf always wanted to interrogate somebody.
Right. Yeah, I think that Worf's idea of interrogating somebody and Odo's idea of interrogating someone are two completely different things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In fact, in this one, Worf says, would you be open to something slightly more intimidating or aggressive? He uses some sort of term like that.
And I love, last issue we were mentioning the artwork on Worf. But this week, this month, the kudos, I think, go to Garrick.
There's a few poses here that I think they just got spot on. I don't know, Charles, what you think about the art, but I think they nailed Quark a couple of times. I think they nailed Worf. Yeah, what do you think?
I think he doesn't overshade the character. Yes, I think we do have some good work on some of these characters.
Yeah, Garrick looks really good. I mean, all the characters have the style is kind of interesting because it's so kind of high contrast compared to some of the painted things that we've seen in the past. So it's an interesting style, and I find every one of the pages really rich. There's always a lot of colors, a lot of text box, relatively interesting panel layouts and nothing too crazy, but enough variation to kind of keep you interested. I actually really like the art in these books. I agree, Jim.
And, you know, something else that they did in this book is on the TV show Deep Space Nine, we saw the bridge, we saw the promenade, We saw a couple of characters' quarters. We saw some hallways. That was it. That's all we ever saw of Deep Space Nine. That was it, you know. But in this comic book, though, there's whole sections of Deep Space Nine that we've never explored or we've never seen on the TV show, which I thought was great. Like the dirty, scungy underbelly of the station,
mm-hmm.
you know, where all these criminals and I think they're mechanics, I think, aren't they? Fixing ships and stuff down in the bowels of the station or something.
Yeah, I'm not sure what their jobs are, but they're I think the sort of game that he busts up is just some folks who are the smugglers that kind of get things in and out of the station. I mean, like the show, the sense that you get from this book is that there is a seedy underworld to the DS9 that Odo's well aware of. He knows what's up, and he allows part of it to kind of operate because when he needs to come smashing in and get some information, he can. that's what I think.
Yeah, I like that. Well, I like the fact. Because so many times we just see straight up Federation stuff, but in this book, we see the richness that Deep Space Nine brought to Star Trek. We see Vedic, we see the spiritual and religious side where with the Vedic, and we see the shady underside with the criminals, and I really enjoyed it, the texture that they gave the station in this book.
Well, not only did they get that area, we also got some of the access tunnels, which
mm-hmm.
we also didn't see a lot of either.
Yeah, I like
that's where the one the corpse showed up.
Mm-hmm, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, lots of different scenes where we kind of get many different. I mean, you're in a city, right? You're in a space station, which is essentially a city. And
yep.
It always makes me wonder if the station is organized kind of from bottom up, you know, like some of these kind of classic science fiction things, you know, organized societies from the bottom up. Was DS9 organized that way? Did the seedy underbelly actually happen at the bottom of the station? Did it happen near one of the docking pylons? I don't know. I'd like to know more.
Yeah, that's the way I read it. But I enjoyed it though. I thought it was really good. I mean, there's so much on Deep Space Nine that we just don't get to see, or we have never seen, and they take the opportunity in this book to show us a lot of stuff that we've never seen, which I thought was great.
Yeah, and I'll say I think obviously people who like detective stories are the ones who are going to like this issue or this whole series, actually, probably the best. This issue kind of continues what the first one did a little bit, where you get little side notes that are Odo's investigator's notes on what's going on around him. So you get his internal dialogue.
Crime.
What was that, Charles?
You got the scene of the crime.
Yes, absolutely, yes. Yeah, and it was interesting because I was thinking about that. That felt very Star Trek-y to me, the way that they portrayed that. Like the Bajoran who was murdered at the beginning of the book, you know, they show him slumped over, but it's not overly gory. I mean, they sort of show a black pool underneath him, which I think is how they kind of would have portrayed that on the actual show. You know, it wouldn't have necessarily been very gory back in the 90s, and it feels like a pretty accurate portrayal to me in the comics.
The Ferengi weren't very or either. I think it was a very simple oops, they're gone.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think was a good effect.
And I think we get to see probably at least three new races that I don't remember ever seeing in any of Star Trek, and it is when Odo busts up the card game, those smugglers there. There's sort of a blue bald guy with elf ears that has these big bags under his eyes. There's sort of another dude that has kind of orc teeth. And then there's another person who just, I don't know, kind of looks like a zombie human. So three new races that I don't think we've seen show up on Star Trek before. At least I don't recognize them. Do you guys?
A group of smugglers that are kind of new to us, a race that if we've seen them, we haven't seen much of them.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't recognize them.
We do
them.
See an Andorian, though. There's an Andorian,
yeah.
And the Andorian is in Starfleet, I might add.
We've been really kind of finding that pretty cool lately. We've been seeing more and more of these. We said, you know, man, it'd be cool if we saw more Andorians in Starfleet, and here they are popping up here and there. So that is pretty cool, Jim. I agree. And not only that, but did you count the pips on that Andorian?
It's a captain.
Yeah.
Captain level, right?
You look at that same shot, we got an Andorian. We got a teller at that table, too.
I think so. Yeah, for sure.
This is a Starfleet meeting.
Mm-hmm.
This is a Starfleet meeting, so I think we've got some. We've got both of them in there. And unusual to see both of them at the table peacefully.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I like the fact that that we saw an Andorian.
I'll say
Charles
so far
is right, that's a Tellarite.
Yep,
it is.
That is
a Tellarite.
Yep. And I will say that they have not focused a lot on too many of the other characters. And obviously, Odo is the focus of this series. They kind of sprinkle in some Kira, some Dax, some Sisko here and there into the story. I like the way that they're represented artistically. I don't think there's enough of them to really say whether or not I think they're doing a good job writing in their voice. But I will say that I do think they're doing a good job writing in both Odo and Worf's voices. You know, when I read them, the words seem to ring true. Yeah, go ahead, Charles.
Well, I think this is we've always had episodes where they were centered around a single character. We got Daz with other characters, but the story was focused on a single character. And I think this is definitely because the mystery involves the Deep Space Nine, it's an Odo episode. And we get the different characters work in from there. But we want to focus the fact that it is Odo and what Odo is seeing.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, it feels very, very DS9 episode-y. You know, it kind of is moving in a good way. And I will say that sometimes these arcs can feel stretched to me when it's a kind of like one investigation going on over a long period of time. This one continues what the first one started, which is that trend. In the third one, I'll be interested to see if there is some action. You know, in the first one, we had the initial explosion. This one was pretty low key, you know, no shooting, no running through the station. They bust up some criminals.
Worf going in there trying to muscle in a little bit, which was good.
A little bit, yep. A little bit of manhandling by Worf. That is true. But I bet that they'll go back and they'll give us a little bit of action in issue 3. That'd be my guess.
But I think I'm also really curious why they chose the mystery character at the end. I think he is going to be a key point at the end. He is going to be a key point next issue.
So is that somebody, that's not somebody we've ever seen before, right?
No.
Okay.
Nobody recognizes him, and I think he's a new character.
Yeah, so he's a new, and I was, so just, I guess I should preface this by saying spoiler alert, right? Because we've probably already spoiled something. But on the very last page, if you don't want to know what's on the last page of the comic, pause the podcast now.
Skip ahead about 30 seconds, a couple times.
Yeah. But the person who shows up is full Betazoid. And so what we're reminded of at that point, and I constantly forget this, I guess, unless I think about Luaxana Troy, but remember, full Betazoids are basically, they can read minds. They can tell exactly what they're thinking. It's not a Deanna Troi situation where she can sense emotions or overall feelings or that kind of thing. This is like, you know, you can actually tell exactly what they're thinking. You know, Worf's thinking about whether this guy can beat him in single combat, and he calls it out. So I like that little reminder. It seems like that type of person, a full Betazoid, would make a darn good investigator and might give Odo a run for his money.
Yep. So I like his reaction to Odo.
Mm-hmm.
Which I really want to see how that gets resolved.
He steps out of the access, and he walks up to Sisko and he says, Nice to meet you, Captain Sisko. To answer your unspoken question, yes, I am Betazoid. Then he walks up to Worf and says, No, Lieutenant Commander Worf, I don't think I could defeat you in single combat. Yes, Lieutenant Commander Dax, I did meet Curzon Dax once. And yes, Major Kira, I can read Bajoran minds too. Then he turns to Odo and he says, but you, Chief of Security Odo, you remain a blank to me. It's like you're not even here.
Mm-hmm.
To be continued.
Dun, dun,
which is
dun,
interesting
dun, dun, dun.
Because I don't think we ever knew that about a founder, right? That they couldn't, that a Betazoid couldn't actually hear their thoughts. And I actually, this actually, I had one question for you guys about this, and it's sort of side related to this comic, but at the very beginning of TNG, in episode number 4, season 1, it's called The Last Outpost. It's the episode where the Ferengi are introduced. And early on in that episode, Troy says something like, I can't sense their thoughts, when Grawl first comes on the screen. She's like, I can't sense their thoughts. And then later on in that episode, she says that she can sense emotions from the Ferengi. And so my question to you guys is, can a Betazoid sense Ferengi emotions or not? Any thoughts on that?
We've never really had a
question. Go ahead, Charles.
I would say I don't know, because in most connections with the Ferengi, we've only had one Betazoid, and I'm not sure how she acted the corpse.
Mm-hmm.
We've only had the Waxana on DS9. I think that's our biggest interaction between the Betazoid and Ferengi, and she really wasn't worrying about sensing mind at that point.
Right.
I was under the impression, guys, that that Betazoids can read people's minds, Ferengi's minds, anybody's minds, because they're Betazoids. However, I was always under the impression that Deanna Troi, being a half-breed, half-human, half-Betazoid, kind of like Spock, she couldn't read minds, but she could read emotions. And that's what she could do. She couldn't read your minds, but she could read your emotions, whereas Betazoids could read your complete thoughts and really didn't care about your emotions because they could read your thoughts. So that's what made Deanna Troi so unique. At least that's the way I always took it.
Yeah, and her powers, so to speak, took on a special empathetic nature, right? When somebody else was in extreme pain, it was almost like it was overwhelming to Troi, because she automatically picked up on their pain, and it just was like she almost like absorbed it. I would not imagine that would happen with Luaxana Troi necessarily. I think you're right, Jim. I think she would read a thought and, you know, and then put on something fabulous and walk away.
Yeah, exactly.
Whereas Troi is like, you know, Troi is like, oh my God, I feel your pain. Oh my God, it's terrible. Oh my God, what can I do for you? You know, which is probably why Picard chose her as the ship's counselor.
Which is why she was so awesome in the Picard episode, Nepenthe, I might add. So, so before we get too far, we got to talk about the Khan book, Hell's Mirror. Overall, what would you guys give this book on a scale of 1 to 10?
The Too Long a Sacrifice? I would probably give this book about a 7 to a 7.5. I'm interested. I want to see where the story goes. Yeah, I'll go 7.5 to 8 because I do love the art. I think the art is really interesting. So let's go. I'll give you one number here. 7.75. There we go.
That's a good number. How about you, Charles?
I'll go 7.85.
There we go. I could go with that too.
It's still got my interest. I still want to know where it's going.
I do too. I'm a little worried about Jim's comment from the last time we reviewed issue 1, which was that the woman blew up her own shop. And I'm like, oh man, this book is still kind of pointing in that direction. So I'm a little, that's kind of why it's not above it. Because I feel like I know where the story's going already.
Maybe
if
not.
You notice, she wasn't in this issue at all. And if the Betazoid guy runs into her, he'll know right away.
That is also true. Yeah, good point.
So, but yeah, I'm there with you guys. Maybe 7.6, maybe.
Yeah, right in that
area.
If this is a four-parter, they can't just immediately solve it right away and accept it next issue.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be a little complicated.
That is true.
Well, it better be more complicated than her, because if we get to the end and it's her, I'm going to have to go back and change all my scores and drop them down a much, much lower if it ends up to be her. But as it stands right now, I'll leave it where it is.
That's good.
So we also have a one-shot. They've been giving us one-shots, which is pretty cool. And this one is called Hell's Mirror. Con in the Mirror Universe, something that, you know, is interesting, right? Something that we never really thought about.
Yep.
He doesn't have a goatee, though. That surprised me.
Nope, just well, just Spock
had a little,
so far. Just Spock.
You know, but yeah. So the cover of this one is a lot more interesting than the Deep Space Nine cover. You know.
Yeah, I mean, it features Khan. It's got a really big head of Khan, and then it has smaller versions of Spock and Kirk kind of next to him. It's got some nice kind of hellish lettering that says Hell's Mirror. And then it has this kind of nice retro feel because the Enterprise, the ISS Enterprise, is kind of swooshing across the cover on the bottom as if it was like a sticker or a barcode or something on the bottom. And it says a whole new universe to win. So, man. I tell you what, if you were just even half a Star Trek fan and walking through the comic shop, I would see this and I'd be like, yep, let's grab it. I love Khan, love ISS, let's do it.
Yep.
The one thing that I will say, they do with their one-shots, and I want to know what you guys think about this. They charged an extra $1 for this issue. And granted, you do get a very nice cover. It's made of nice, really thick paper, feels really good in the hand. The pages have kind of the typical high quality glossy feel of an IDW page. As far as I could tell, however, there were no more pages. And so basically I feel like I paid an extra $1 for maybe thicker paper on the cover. I don't know. What do you guys think about the $4.99 price tag on this one?
Yeah, it did feel like a thicker book. You're right. The cover does feel thicker. I'm holding it in my hand, comparing it to the Deep Space Nine one. It does feel heavier, but I don't know if how many pages are in it. I didn't look.
It's the same number. Yeah.
Oh, is it? Okay. All right. Yeah, okay.
Maybe it isn't any longer.
It's just a dollar more.
I'm recounting.
I don't know.
Okay, it is slightly longer. Okay, so maybe that's where the extra $1 comes in. There are like a few more pages at the end. So maybe that's where the extra $1 comes from, is the extra long length and then the paper. I don't know. Maybe I'm still living in the days of $1.50 comics.
Stock, so you're only going to, it's not going to go to a trade paperback. This is going to be it.
Right. That's true. So you're not going to be able to buy that nice quality trade paperback cover that will allow you to read the whole series. This is it. This is the one that goes on your shelf.
Yep.
Unless they put out a special one-shot with all the one-shots in it, because this is like, what, our third or fourth one-shot?
Yeah, boy, that would be a lot of mixing, but they all come out of IDW.
Either.
Yeah.
So, this story, it really intrigued me. I was very interested in it, but yeah, I wasn't
this is a big
too book. Thrilled.
Well,
but
I mean, so here's my first question for you guys, and I could not resolve this in my head, and I know I shouldn't be a stickler for continuity, but they have done such an amazing job in these comics lately, keeping canon adjacency, you know, keeping things in a universe whereby the comics could actually fit into the continuity. The writers maybe were shared between the TV shows and the comics and that sort of thing. This one is more like the pocketbooks of the past. This blows continuity out of the water. I tried to figure out when this book happens. And at first you're kind of like, well, it must happen before Mirror Mirror because Spock is not Emperor, right? And Kirk's on the ISS Enterprise. And yet during this story, Kirk destroys the ISS Enterprise, which obviously shows up in the episode Mirror Mirror. So it doesn't fit in. It just doesn't fit.
And then we also know from JK's little mini story in the mirror that Data goes after and hunts down Spock. You know?
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know. That was my biggest... I enjoyed reading it, and I found it to be an interesting read, and I enjoyed it. It seemed like a holodeck adventure to me because it doesn't make sense, and it doesn't fit in with what we know. And like you, I couldn't figure out where to fit it in because it doesn't jive with what we know.
Okay,
you know,
so,
let's
take that, Jim, and let's put aside the fact that we can't fit it into continuity. What did you guys think, you and Charles both, think about the actual portrayal of Khan, though, in this story? Like, was this a Khan that you would believe? Charles, do you believe this is a Khan that accurately represents kind of what you would expect to see in a mirror Khan?
I think in some ways how we look at mirror characters. Okay, I'll give you a prime example. Tilly. So if I look at Tilly and Tilly, I believe this one to be Khan. This, I believe, is a Khan, I would imagine, in the mirror universe. Because he's not as much portrayed as the Conqueror, as more the protector.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's more of a protector. He's trying to save the universe, not conquer the universe.
In fact, he says somewhere in this book that he's trying to form, what's the word he uses? Federation. He's trying to form a federation, right?
Yeah.
What do you think,
yeah,
Jim?
And this Khan doesn't know about this Khan.
Oh, no.
Spock knows about the Federation. Well, wait, no, it
doesn't. Well,
he doesn't.
Well,
I don't know at all.
Depending on when the story happens. Yeah.
Okay. None of that is relevant.
No,
what's relevant here?
Forget about Mirror Mirror.
Khan does not know about the Federation. He has no knowledge whatsoever that it exists. Never heard the name. Knows nothing about it. So let's Khan himself. We can worry about what Kirk and Spock know based on, but Khan himself doesn't know anything about the Federation. I also found
it
really fascinating.
Is it Spock breaks off?
What's that, Charles?
Yeah.
Is it Mirror Mirror where Spock breaks off and tries to go on his own?
Well, that's the one where at the end of Mirror Mirror, Kirk is killed and Spock inherits the Empire and he sort of decides to take it in a different direction.
Okay.
Right.
Like Mirror Mirror
but
is basically what leads into the Terran Empire that we see during DS9, which is totally, you know, mirror opposite of what we see in TOS.
I found this Khan to be a very intellectual character. I found also this Khan is not the Khan that we see in Wrath of Khan because he hasn't been stranded on the planet. He hasn't been stranded on SETI Alpha yet. So this is a Khan that was really highly educated, read a lot of books. I mean, he's quoting Shakespeare and Wrath of Khan left and right. And he has books on the Botany Bay. So he's a very intelligent, very well-read individual. And he comes off that way in the comic book. I feel that his character is very true to how he might be if he wasn't deranged and filled with vengeance and hate. So, yes, I think he was a good character.
Well, when you said he's not trapped on SETI Alpha 5, if you look at the story, when they go into the cavern, that cavern is below SETI Alpha 5. So SETI Alpha 5 is in his prison. That's where the housing part of his hold.
Yeah. Yeah, and I really dug at the beginning the way that they really separated this story from the story of the augments that we know from Enterprise. You know, in this mirror story, well, first of all, let's review what happens in the Prime story. In the Prime story, the augments are created. Then eventually the augments, you know, help to sort of conquer the Earth in various different ways, but then they start fighting amongst themselves. And eventually everybody is exiled after they have kind of fought against themselves. In this story, you know, you get on the first page Khan talking about how these 85 augments were created and that it was the people who waged the war themselves that the augments almost like couldn't stop. And then they went to sleep. And then when Khan woke up, that was when the Terran Empire suddenly was part of the show, because we know the Terran Empire actually started as, you know, we were shown the starting of the Terran Empire in a Mirror Darkly during Enterprise, you know, that scene from First Contact, but the mirror version of that. So this book takes place before that. And so Khan goes to sleep. The world is at war. He wakes up. The Terran Empire has taken over everything. So I do think that that kind of frames his thought process. And he's like, oh my God, look at all the terrible things these stupid humans have done. I need to be a force to help bring them together, which is what he spends this book doing.
Now, what did you think about the fact, this is, okay, we have to forget what we know about the Mirror Universe and about Spock and about Kirk. Otherwise, we can't discuss this if we try to make it fit what we know. So let's forget
right.
what we know. What did you think about the fact that Spock had defected and was working with Khan as his right-hand man?
Well,
you know,
well, do we...
because Spock met... Mirror Spock met Prime Kirk, I think that the stage that kind of released him to thinking there was an alternative. And so I think Spock was creating a revolution at that point. And at one point he may have reached, maybe we can use Khan as part of the revolution, or maybe not.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we'd have to time this one after Mirror Mirror somehow for that. Well, forgetting what we know. No, you're right. You're right, Charles. That could be a possibility. I like that.
Yeah, because
yeah.
Spock actually says at one point that the Vulcan, based on his computations, it was only 6.85 decades or whatever he came up with before the rest of the Vulcans would realize that and they would revolt or something like that.
What his big calculation was in this book was he calculated that if he didn't help Khan, the universe was going to be plunged for like 2,000 years into disparity. And I think that that was lip service to Khan. I mean, that was my impression, because at the end, you know, Spock sort of sticks with Kirk, so to speak. It could be that his alliance all along was a ruse.
Yeah, and Kirk, you know, here lots of buts. When
mm-hmm.
Kirk is talking to Khan and he turns around and he blows away the mirror Rand, then he blows away Sulu, he blows away Chekhov, just kills them on the bridge, kills the whole bridge crew, beams over to Khan's ship, and then blows up the Enterprise. I was like, what the? No. What am I looking at? Kirk would never, never blow up his crew and his ship. He would never
Hold on, Jim.
Not Mirror, we're told to.
Yeah, we're Mirror Kirk here, man. We are Mirror Kirk. Remember that during Mirror Mirror, Mirror Kirk spends most of his time like enraged, like a crazy man, right? Spock is the reasonable one in that episode. I don't think we have any idea from that episode what Mirror Kirk is really capable of. And I actually could see him blowing up his entire crew for the right reason, for personal gain, because I think in the Terran Empire, the way you get ahead is you kill everybody behind you, right? So nobody can catch up to where
yep.
you are.
No, not everybody behind you, everybody above you.
Well, those people too, one at a time. But then you make sure you don't leave anybody behind who's going to catch you either.
But he has a Tantalus field, so he can wipe out anybody he wants at any time. Mm-hmm. Blowing up the ship blows up his advantage. Unless
yeah,
he
I guess
took
that's,
it with
that's
him,
that's
I guess.
Point.
Unless that was part
I hate
of the
to
plan.
Be a gatekeeper. I really, really do. I can't stand it when and again, I got to say this. This is what I am enjoying so immensely about the Discovery books that we're currently reading on Book Nook, because in my mind, they fit neatly and perfectly into what we know and understand about the Star Trek characters on Discovery. And there's none of this trying to twist and finagle and justify and catalog and make things work like in this book.
And that's really important, Jim, because the reason that we read stories like this is that we like the characters and we want to know more about the characters. We want to learn what makes them tick, right? We want to know why they make the decisions they make. And if it's not consistent or if it doesn't fit into, if you have to do more than a small wiggle to make it fit into what you know, then it becomes like the old pocketbooks that we always refer to. You know, it's like, well, that was a cool story. I really enjoyed it. It doesn't mean anything. Whereas when I read a Discovery book right now, I'm like, oh, now I understand why Saru did that in Discovery season one, because he had this cool like thing that happened to him when he was in Starfleet when he was younger. You know what I mean? So yeah, I agree.
Right, right.
Well, just as the
so
DS9 book
let's make
tied directly to the series itself.
Right.
Let's just say right now, let's review this book. Let's take this book as a total, absolute.
Yeah.
Standalone book that has nothing to do with anything. And let's just judge
right.
the book based on what is between the covers and not what we know about what Spock did or what you, or the Tantalus field or what, you know, what, let's just base it on what we read in the book. How's that?
Mm-hmm.
All right.
The only way we can.
Well, something I want to comment in this
yeah.
book that I thought was interesting that caught me every time I ran into it was the fact that this opens up like a Star Trek episode, like a TOS episode, because you got the opening teaser, then we get the title of the episode at the commercial. In this one, we get through the capture, and then we get the title of the book inside the book. When you
mm-hmm.
look at the explosion of the Enterprise, it says right there, Star Trek, the old mirror, as if we're introducing the title. Giving me a feel
yeah, you're
of
right.
Star Trek episode.
So, Charles, should that page have been a full page rather than being the Enterprise blowing up on the top two-thirds of the page and then four panels below with some dialogue and stuff below? Should that have been a full page if they're going to do that?
Full page might have worked, but I think it's just the emphasis of the fact of like, okay, there's the open, now we're going to get into our story. So they get a little separation there, which most comics don't do.
Mm-hmm.
That was a unique thing to sit there and put the intro in there, and then we get the title of the episode, which
yeah.
we get in Star Trek, because we'll get a teaser, and then we're going to get the opener, and the opener is going to give us the title of the episode.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I want to say that I think the artwork in this book is really good.
Mm-hmm.
I really enjoy the colors. It's very colorful, and the panels are laid out. They're really well done.
Mm-hmm.
The lettering is easy to read and easy to follow. You know, the panels aren't all square. There's some circular ones. There's some diagonal ones. it flows. It's really easy on the eyes, I found. The lettering is good. The characters look really good. The artwork. Who did the artwork? Was it Jay? Who did this one?
This one, Matthew, the artist Dow is Matthew Smith. Dow Smith. Yeah.
So yeah, I really like the colors. I like the way the pages are laid out. And like Charles said, he's right. You get the intro and then you get the title page, like you were watching an episode. And yeah, the characters look really good. You know, we get a little bit of insight into Captain Kirk growing up as a farm boy and in Iowa and reading books that he's not supposed to read. And yeah, I really enjoyed the layout of the book. I enjoyed the artwork of the book. And I think they did a really, really good job with the overall presentation of this story. What did you think, Charles?
Yes, I agree. The presentation is very well done. I agree with you. The color work's done. The inking is very well done. The story flows. It keeps you going through the book. It was just,
yeah.
I think I know what Jim's thought is towards the end, and I kind of agree to that. I'm probably going to agree to that.
And what do you think? What do you think, Eric?
Yeah, overall, I'm very positive about this one, despite the fact that we can't wedge it into canon. I think the most interesting thing about it is the insight into Kirk's background and psyche that you were just referencing. You know, you find out here there's like a mind meld, right? Khan, first of all, there are not very many times that we see non-Vulcans try to attempt mind melds. We saw it on the Picard series, where the android actually is able to do mind melds. And in this one, we see Khan, the student of mind melds, attempting a mind meld with Kirk. But, you know, Spock references, he says, well, the memories that I saw were actually real and your blockers were not working properly. So that makes me know that there's like some training, some conditioning that goes on with Terran Empire, probably captain, maybe even further down. And then it didn't work. And that's why we got that little insight into Kirk's psyche. And then at the very end, they reference back to it because they show a book that references his thoughts from when he was a child in his drawer on whatever ship they're on there at the end. So I really like actually what they did with the Kirk character in this one, probably the best. The Khan was pretty cool. I did like that he was a liberator and a good guy, a force for good, rather than the kind of evil, vengeful Khan that we get in Wrath of Khan. So, yeah, overall, I dug this book. I wish they could have just tweaked it just a little to make it fit into the story somehow. I feel like they could have if they just hadn't blown up the Enterprise. I feel like that would have done the trick, right? They should have found a way to get him off the Enterprise without blowing it up. And then they could have just fit it right into what we already know. But, say, so, Lovie, it was still
new
a good
ISS
book.
Enterprise.
I guess so, yeah, the refit.
I'm going to have to give this book 2 scores, if you guys don't mind.
Here we go. I love it.
If I'm taking this book as a standalone and I'm throwing out all the canon adjacent and I'm just looking at this book as a one-shot story and I'm not being influenced by what I know or what I think I know, I would give this book an 8.5, 8.7.
Yeah.
I might go as high as a 9. Okay, the layout, the artwork, the story, the inking, everything. I really, really would give this book a very, very high score. Like I said, 8.5, maybe even a 9. If I'm trying to look at this book as a Star Trek book, it doesn't work for me. There's too many holes in it. It doesn't fit. They switch the roles of Kirk and Spock at the end where Kirk is the one who's questioning the Federation, whereas we know that it's actually Mirror Spock that questions I don't know. So if I'm trying to fit this into the Star Trek world, there's just too many holes, and I would have to give this book a 6, maybe even 5.8. if I'm looking at it as a Star Trek book, because of the gaping holes and inconsistencies. What about you, Eric?
Yeah, I actually feel like those are very fair scores. I might even go a little bit lower on the second score, but I think 8.5 is very fair. I totally dug this book. Art is great, story is great, panel layout's great, colors are great, totally awesome. But man, it sure does not fit into Star Trek lore, which is too bad, because when I was done with it, I was so excited about this book, guys, so excited. And then I finished it and I was like, oh, yeah, it doesn't really fit in, does it? So I'm going to give it an 8.5/5.0.
Yeah, all right. And what about you? Get to bring up the caboose, Charles.
All right. Well, I think I'll agree with the 8.5 in the main story, but the ending wasn't what I was expecting. But it also gives me the point of how it ended. Makes me wonder if this was a Terran plot, that they planned this out planting Kirk as a seed into the situation. Because Spock rather supports him at the end on that one, which kind of makes me thinking that this might have been sort of a Terran plot in the first place. But about a 6.5/7, I think, on the whole story, just because I don't like how they ended it. I think they could have ended differently.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how would you have felt if we changed one simple panel, just one panel in the book, and it ends with Spock sitting at the table asking that question instead of Kirk? Wouldn't that change the whole way you look at the story just by making that one change?
The question about the his past, or
when Kirk is sitting at the end of the book, I think the last page is him sitting at his desk in the dark, and he's got the book in his desk.
Yeah,
and he's thinking about, you know, the future and what's to come and what to change, and if they had made that character, that panel, be Spock, sitting there in the dark. Am I in the wrong?
You might be remembering the last page wrong. Yeah, the last page on this one is basically Spock talking to Kirk and telling him that, I looked in your mind, and it was, you know, it was the real. It's the discussion about whether or not the memories that he saw in his head were real or not on that last page. And that's the scene that I was talking about that I love so much, because it's the one where Kirk is like, Spock's like, I saw what was in your brain. It was real. And Kirk's like, nope, wasn't real. And Spock's like, yep, it was. And he's like, nope, you were mistaken. Report me to our superiors if you don't believe me, but it was not real. And then he tells him, get the hell out of here. And he walks away. And then Kirk looks in the drawer and he sees the Once and Future King book that Spock saw when he did the mind meld with him, that he read as a child. So that I love that.
But then the word underneath Kirk, as Kirk is sitting in the dark looking at the book, the word says hope.
Hope.
And I'm thinking that if this was the Spock, if this was Spock, it would easier fit into what we know about where Spock actually ends up later on.
But
you don't know what Kirk's hope is.
Well, that line, Jim, is in the black, the yellow lettering on the black background, which means that it's actually a continuation of Khan's line from the previous page. So if you were to put Khan's line not spanning across the interaction between Kirk and Spock, it would say, as Khan's dying, he would say, why then, as I take my last breath, do I feel myself clinging to an absurd, illogical hope? So that's the moment where we learn that Khan, in the end, was just hopeful that he could change the world. And despite the fact that he was defeated by Kirk, he still has hope that things will change.
Huh. Okay, cool. Well, you know what time it is, guys?
No.
Yep. Yeah, hard to believe.
Hour already.
Ding.
Yep. But hey, guys, we got a really big treat for you guys. Our next Book Nook, which is going to be on Saturday, October 3rd at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, we're going to have Una McCormick with us, and she's going to be talking with us live about The Way to the Stars, which we refer to as the Tilly book for Star Trek Discovery. It was a fantastic read, and we're lucky enough to have the author with us. So mark your calendars for Saturday, October 3rd at 2 p.m. Make sure you're here. Give us a call. Ask some questions. We're going to talk about Way to the Stars. We're also going to talk a little bit about the Picard book, Last Best Hope, which I did not read, but Eric and Charles did. And we might even throw in some Trek talking with Una while we're at it. So please mark your calendars for that, Saturday, October 3rd. And, of course, Thursday night we have Trek talking. We're going to be talking about Star Trek Discovery, Star Trek Birthdays, Star Trek News, and we're going to be reviewing the latest episode, episode 8, Vertas, I think that's the name of the episode, of Star Trek Lower Decks. So tune in for that. And we're out of time. So I want to say thank you to Eric for hanging out with us. Eric, thank you very much.
You bet. A blast as always, guys.
And Charles, what would it be without Charles with us as well? Thank you very much for hanging out with us,
yeah.
Charles.
Oh, talking,
and of course, thank you.
Talking Trek stories is always fun.
It's always a fun time. And of course, thank you to each and every one of you guys. You know, we wouldn't be doing this if you guys weren't listening. So thank you. Thank you very much for listening. It was a blast. I want to say good night, and I want to tell everybody to stay safe and be good to each other. Hailing frequencies are closed. Good night, everybody.
Good night, y'all.
Live long and prosper.
Let's see what's out there. Engage. Thank you.